If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
Some of you may know that I grew up in a family business run by my dad, a grocery store, but it had a butcher shop. It was known far and wide on the Southwest side, and I know that quality means something, and that's why we drive 2 hours from Northwest Indiana all the way to the Northwest side of the city of Chicago to Joseph's Finest Meats at 7101 West Addison Street. Before you go there, you got to be prepared, so I've got a list for you. Do you have a pen? Italian sausage, hot. Italian sausage, mild. Get pork chops, but order them thick. And of course, get some beef too, like bone-in ribeye steaks. Nothing like it. And if you don't know exactly what to get or how to cook it, ask Ben or Sal and tell them John Cass sent you. And I'd like to tip my hat to Joseph, the patriarch, the owner, the founder who built this store for his family with his two sons, Ben and Sal. In his mid-90s, he had serious heart surgery and he made a triumphant return. He loves his place, and I do too. And so does anyone who shops there. It's like family. They care about the details. They care about you. Joseph's Finest Meats, 7101 West Addison Street, Chicago. A family tradition since 1977, and a proud sponsor of John Cass News and the Chicago Way podcast.
Well, I know that you're still struggling to recover from that awesome 250th birthday celebration for America, but my voice is gone. I can't speak because I was shouting, "I believe that we will win," at the top of my lungs. And now Jeff Carlin is going to pick it up.
Thanks, John. Yes, as you can hear, John's voice is raspy at best, but he'll fight through for this episode of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus with myself, Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio, and of course, John Cass, executive editor of johncassnews.com, where for less than a dollar a week, you can get a full cup of Midwestern common sense served right to your mailbox. And what are we talking about today? We are talking about just that, the idea that it's 250 years and where are we and where have we been and where should we go, with none other than Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, our friend, big brain, big mind, who writes so eloquently about really complex things and makes them very simple to understand. Check him out at charleslipson.com for his latest and greatest. And where are you as the smoke settles on a fireworks display near you and the mortar shells are hitting planes coming in and out of Midway and the Republic hopes to make a bid for another 250 years? You're on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way, that's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
I'm stuffy. I believe it. I don't know it. I'm stuffy. A lot of allergies, pollen in the air. And that's too bad because I wanted to serenade our friend, Charles Lipson, the cowboy from Austin, Texas.
John, it's the only way you could ever be stuffy.
Exactly. Well, I paid my admittance. I'd like to hear you sing. Let's get it going. One, two, three.
I believe in Cheyenne. I'm bound for Montana. I believe in Cheyenne.
Goodbye, old paint. I'm leaving Cheyenne. How's that?
That's great. So that's an allusion to Charles picking up his stakes and heading to Austin.
Yeah, John picked up from Chicago and got as far as the Indiana border, and that was it for him. But I kept moving.
I was trying to get back. I was trying to get back east.
He didn't want to abandon the snow and the Italian beef.
Oh man! Oh man! Well, I'm here in Austin, where both my adult children live with their families, and we moved from the Hyde Park neighborhood. And I want to tell you something about the celebration of the 4th here, not the public fireworks and so forth, but the kind of quiet things that people do on their own street. And in Chicago, in my neighborhood, which was near the University of Chicago in Hyde Park, you could go all around Hyde Park and you would just not see an American flag on the 4th. I flew one on my front porch, and one of my neighbors, who is a professor who studies the period before the Civil War, flies one that has the circle, the stars in a circle from the 1830s. But that's really it. Here in my little neighborhood, which is on the outskirts of Austin, a middle-class type neighborhood, I would say every other house, maybe more, has at least one flag and sometimes more than one.
Do they have that don't tread on me flag?
No, they don't.
I love that.
I do too. But the state that originated it, they're the ones who lie down and are treaded upon. But I'll tell you how many flags there are here, John. There are so many that there is one house with a sign supporting a Democratic candidate for Senate, Tallarico.
Yes.
That actually has an American flag. That's how patriotic people are. There was a Democratic household that flew an American flag.
With over three decades of serving up streetwise insight and local perspective on Page 2, the voice of John Cass has a home at johncassnews.com.
There's a new sheriff in town.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have.
But as he settles in, can you deal with the hysteria, the meltdowns, the constant whining?
I don't know what to do.
You know what you need? You need a good cup of common sense.
It's just common sense.
Like the kind of common sense you get when you subscribe to johncassnews.com. I'm John Cass, 40 years a journalist in Chicago.
The Chicago way.
I opened this website, John Cass News, so that you could have a decent cup of common sense.
This great country of ours was built on its entrepreneurial spirit.
It's time that you join the frontier of independent journalism at johncassnews.com.
Subscribe today to get access to great columns from John Cass, Dan Proft, and others. Don't be a chum alone and subscribe at johncassnews.com.
Is that the fellow who's running that on the platform that God is not binary or something, that God is all
genders? I think he means that God can go in use either locker room in a high school.
There you go.
But he's also said things like the American flag is a very complicated symbol. But I got to tell you that the guy who's running against him has got a lot of problems too, Ken Paxton.
Right, but
I don't want to get into Texas politics.
Why not? I don't care.
Because I don't pay any attention. I hardly paid attention in Chicago to local politics. I just watched it circle the drain.
Oh,
yeah. The thing about the thing you notice here in Texas, although Austin, is a liberal city,
decidedly so,
is that you just have really good public services, and the streets are well paved. There's not a lick of garbage on the streets. Everything is picked up. There's no state taxes. So they're not doing it with that kind of funding. It's just a well-governed state, and people are moving here. They're moving to Tennessee, which has no state taxes. They're moving to Florida. But it's not just the lack of state taxes. It's that public services are much more competent. I was just seeing that in California now, They are functionally bankrupt. There's no way they can pay the pension obligations that they now have to state employees. And there are federal court rulings, longstanding federal court rulings, that promised pension benefits cannot be reduced for public employees. So they've got to pay these people, and they have not funded these. And I think this is true across a lot of blue states. You're also seeing something, and none of the European states allow this, right? If you live in Manchester or Birmingham or something, you can't, or live in London, you can move to Manchester or Birmingham if you think that there's sort of better local governance, but you won't get any difference in taxes or anything like that. That's just not true in America.
That's interesting. And Charles, what do you make of the reasoning? I mean, the size difference alone probably has something to do with the service piece. But is there, in your estimation so far, being there, I hate to say it this way, but like a suckling class, a class that is just living entirely off of taxes, like in Chicago?
Not nearly as much. I mean, it's certainly true that you have public sector unions. It's worth remembering that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a major friend of labor, opposed public sector unions. Right. And the reason that public sector unions are different from private unions is that the people who are negotiating with a private union are the people who manage the company, and they are ultimately responsible to shareholders. So they want to have good workers, and they can't pay them too little, or those workers will go to another company. If they can't pay them too much, or the company won't have profits, and they'll lose out to their competitors. But in the case of a public sector union, the people sitting across the table from the union representatives are people who need the vote and the funding and the support of the people they are negotiating with. And nowhere could that be more clear than in Chicago, where the most powerful organization in the whole state now is the Chicago Teachers Union. Used to be the Chicago Democratic Machine, but now it's the Chicago Teachers Union. And look, they've got one of their own guys, a thoroughly incompetent boob, as the as the mayor of Chicago now.
Hey, let's be nice to boobs, Charles. Come on.
Oh, really? You talked about a suckling class. I guess that got me thinking.
I had this in a disagreement with somebody the other day about, well, you know, he's still kind of new.
They're
and
defending
he's kind him. Of, yeah. He's, well, yeah, they're uninformed, and they don't want to be mean. And so that's fine. But the guy has got the fiscal responsibility of a sock full of quarters. I mean, he has owes back water bills. His first, you know, few months in office, he drops $80,000. So is to renovate the office for his wife to use on our dime. Like,
and the city has a lot of problems. And what you're seeing is across, I think, in both parties, the party what used to be the central party governance has completely collapsed, and you certainly saw that in the case of primaries in both parties. You can't win a Republican primary in almost any state. Maybe Maine and Alaska are a little different, but you can't win in a Republican primary if President Trump opposes you. And it's getting harder and harder to win in a Democratic primary if you're not the furthest left candidate on the ballot. With the fact that Dan Goldman got defeated, and he was very progressive. This is a very serious problem in both the Democratic Party, but it's a problem in the
country.
Republican Party. I mean, I noticed today a comment of Steve Bannon, and they always say he says, you know, the United States is being run by Israel. Well, it's just a kind of code word for saying that the Jews are in control of everything. And this is a kind of an old populist theme in both parties, not just about the Jews, but it's about any particular minority group that they want to oppose. I mean, it could be in previous times it was Catholics. It's often blacks. In the South, it certainly was, but
never Greeks. Though I don't know why Greeks have been saved. Why?
Because they're so hospitable, John.
Yeah, I don't know. I personally, John, would never oppose any group that could serve me gyros.
Yeah, with onions.
Absolutely.
It's the old saying, John, you don't bleep where you eat. And if you're going to eat somewhere in a major city, there's a good chance someone Greek has had their hands on it.
And I got to tell you, the idea that you could look at it, that you could look at a gyros, and that people looked at those gyros roasting and invented the gyroscope from that. I think that's so impressive. I mean,
really, that's what Hank Johnson believes.
Hank Johnson, Representative Johnson, was the one who said that if the U.S. he actually asked
a senior admiral,
if we moved all of our troops to one side of an island, wouldn't the island tilt over and sink?
Guam.
And that guy's still in Congress.
Yep.
That's New York for you. All right. Well,
He's from Georgia.
Oh yes, I take that back. He is from Georgia. Now in Chicago, we have a routine weekend mayhem. People getting slaughtered in the streets. And what happens? I don't know if it's really news yet, but Larry Snelling, the police superintendent, has had it up to here with, according to my sources, with Johnson.
Yeah.
And Johnson wanted him to hold a joint news conference to kind of spread around the pain that he was giving. Mm-hmm. And Larry said no. Superintendent said no. And I give him 100% on that. He wasn't going to go out. He wasn't going to play the fool for Johnson on the way out. What do you guys think of that?
Well, I think it's a very serious matter. They haven't hired enough police. The police are not backed by the administration. And then you have judges that let these people out as soon as they come into court. It's a circular system that's very, very bad news. And my sense is that ordinary people have had it. And it's shocking, really, that this sort of thing passes for social justice. Who are the people who are most hurt? They're sort of ordinary, law-abiding, especially lower middle-class people who are just trying to raise their children right, get them an education, and have them rise up.
Black women are victims of these thugs and monsters.
They're pawns.
And they have no chance. And they're the ones who have to take public transportation at night to get to their job.
Let me build on that for a second. Yes, have you seen the demographics of the vote for the so-called Democratic Socialists of America?
Let's hear about it. I want to hear about it.
It is 4% black. 4%. And it's about the same number of working class. It is something on the order of 30% of the membership have graduate degrees, I imagine mostly in social work or something. But the fact is, it's these people who've come out of college with a psychology, sociology, or gender studies degree can't get a job. Or can't get a job that they think is right for themselves, and then they vote for people like Mamdani for mayor, and he imposes rent control. The landlords can't make any money, so there's no new building. People don't maintain their apartments the landlords don't maintain their apartments because there's no money to do it. It just leads to predictable decline.
They're undereducated and they're underqualified, but they have great egos and they believe they're worth all the money that Obama and other people are making. And they're upset that they're not making it. So they're going to wreak havoc on our culture until they get it.
Well, it started with my generation in the 60s rebelling, and we had a good reason to rebel against the Vietnam War. It was a costly mistake and a deadly one. But since then, educated classes of America have been more and more removed from contact with ordinary working people. They claim on the left to be the voice of those people, but I mean, the only ones that they ever see are the people who mow their yards.
Well, that's an amazing stat, and I have no doubt it's true. Only 4% of the Democratic Socialists, how does it go?
Are black. I mean, look at, and you can see this actually in the elections in New York for Congress and so forth. They're different. These congressional districts run across different demographic areas, and you have working class areas, lower middle class, working class areas, and those areas are not voting for the people who claim to be their the flag carriers for those people.
Yeah.
The ones who are voting for them are the baristas at Starbucks,
the white and chicks,
newly hired, fresh out of Yale Law School at a big law firm, but these people are not going to make partner, and they're angry. They're making a huge amount of money. They're making $200,000 a year, those people, not the baristas.
That's not enough for them. But,
yeah, and for them, I mean, there's a book by a guy, God Saad, G-A-D-S-A-A-D.
Right. I'm familiar with him. Yeah, interesting. Man.
Yes, on sort of this empathy that eats itself. It's
suicidal empathy.
It is suicidal. The idea is, I mean, by the way, the other statistic, if you were to look at these people who are so interested in the downtrodden, they give no money to charity.
Yeah.
They absolutely give no money to charity, and you look at people who are the people that they hate, you know, the conservative Christians and so forth, and they give huge amounts to charity.
How can you trust people like that? And then they you know, call themselves all these weird things like socialist feminists and, you know, a democratic socialist or Marxist. They don't even realize what they're saying. Like, they come in and say, oh, America's bad. We're bad. We've done bad things.
Well, that was Mondami's speech.
Right.
His 4th of July speech was, you know, what an awful country it is. And it's so odd to see these first generation immigrants who hate the country. John, you can speak to that a lot better than I can, because you not only did your family move here, but you must have known lots of other people who did. There's a striking difference between people who moved here from Greece after World War II and people who moved from Somalia.
Well, you know what? Mondami is of a class. Indians, I think
South Asian,
ethnic,
yeah.
Ethnic background, Indian, right?
Well, and Indians who lived in Africa.
Yes. In other words, colonists. Yes.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Yeah. They get so mad about the U.S. and say, we're so bad and we've done all these horrible things. And then they call themselves Marxists. And you're like, you know how many people Marxism has killed over the years, right? Oh, no.
150 billion.
Well, that's because exactly. They never did it right. That's because they never did it right.
Right, yeah, right, exactly. That's the thing that kills me. Like, we just go down to the facts, and I'm all about numbers. Republics and democracies, I think, are way behind anything that Marxists and communists could put up as far as raw numbers and ruining humanity and killing people. What was my mind?
It's important to look at one underlying fact there. If basically transactions are voluntary, that is, I buy a car because I want to buy that car. Those people want to sell it to me. We agree on a price. everything in the car was manufactured by somebody who sold it at that price in a voluntary transaction. The people who work at every place that made those things did so voluntarily. And then you switch to a system that is a command system. Everything ultimately is going to be done by someone who has the power to command you. And they can command you where to live. In the Soviet Union, there were internal passports. So I couldn't have moved from Chicago to Texas without a permission from the government. I couldn't have worked in any job without permission from the government. And it's not just that I needed permission. The government would have decided which sectors were going to receive capital. And they can't, they have no way to set a price either on anything. How much should a television sell for? And the answer is, we know what it will sell for in a market economy, because everything is a voluntary transaction. And of course, everybody's trying to make as much money as they can, but that's subject to competition. So they can't just charge $1,000 for a TV that somebody else is charging $500 for. Nobody will buy the $1,000 TV unless it's a heck of a lot bigger or better. But in an economy without a price system, there's no way not only to set the price of the TV, but to tell you how many TVs you should produce relative to how many cars you should produce. So it's a system that ends up being powerfully inefficient, but it always ends up depending upon command. And then the people who are in command are going to take everything for themselves. That's how it always is.
Always, right.
They get the steak, they get the filet, and we get the
trimmings.
Yeah, trimmings. Yeah.
By the way, let me say something about that. Do you know why when an animal is out in the field, it's called a cow, but when it's on the plate, it's called beef? When it's out in a pen, it's called a pig, and when it's on your plate, it's called pork. Do you know the origins of that difference in terminology?
At least now we have a teacher wanting us to know something.
Yes, enlighten us.
Okay. The answer is that when it was out in the field, it was being raised by Anglo-Saxon peasants, and they used their own Anglo-Saxon language. When it was being served to the elite, they had come over in 1066 from France. And language like beef is from boeuf, and boeuf ultimately came from the Latin. Pig is Anglo-Saxon, pork. By the way, that's what, and to get a kind of, to continue on this, if you want to think about how the elite made this common language, denigrated the common language, think about the word for sex, copulation. It's Latinate, right? Now think about what the Anglo-Saxon word is. And of course, the Anglo-Saxon word is considered a curse word, right? So this is, we're not entirely immune from this. This is kind of built into it, but we don't have, unlike medieval England or France or whatever, we don't have a hereditary elite. And that's a big part of the anger that you see on the East Coast from Yale and Harvard and Princeton,
because
they were the old elite and they have been displaced.
Well, now we're going to see the same pattern once again that we began to see in the 2020. I remember when leftist mayors like Lori Lightfoot were in panic that there would be trashed and attacked by the hard left.
Yes, yes.
And they had nothing to say. They couldn't fight. They didn't know what to say.
Well, look at Schumer. Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries are in that position now. All the candidates that Jeffries sponsored in New York lost to candidates that Mamdani supported. Schumer is dead man walking. By the way, the interesting issue there in the Congress, if the Democrats win the House, which is widely but not universally predicted, if they win by a lot, then Jeffries could be not only elected Speaker but have a fair amount of power, at least within the House. But if it's a narrow victory, they're going to be on the order of 20 or so very hard left, really neo-Marxist members of his caucus. And he won't be able to get around them any more than Republican House speakers were able to get around the Tea Party.
Well, they destroyed the Tea Party by adopting it, but they got Livingston and other people,
yeah,
so-called rhinos, to lead the Tea Party and marshal them, and the Republicans never. Tea Party never recovered from this.
Well, to the extent that the Tea Party is really about...
it's a populist thing, yeah.
Yes, to the extent that it was about lowering taxes and so forth, those are standard Republican things. But the populist movement in both Republican and Democratic Party really is removes the guardrails of the constitutional democracy. I mean, the Democrats... would like to make Puerto Rico a state and Washington, D.C. a state. They would like to pack the Supreme Court. I mean, there's all of these. It's not just that they're all bad ideas. They're really a wrecking ball to the constitutional structure in order to achieve immediate outcomes.
What should we do with Puerto Rico, though, Charles? Should we cut them loose? Does that make more sense? They're rather underrepresented.
It turns out that when you put the vote, when you ask Puerto Ricans to vote, they actually prefer the current status. And they don't want to become an independent state, an independent nation. And the reason for that is that they're hugely subsidized.
Right.
By the United States. I mean, we pay a lot of welfare, in effect, to individual citizens.
That's why we bought them.
It was a mistake. But and we avoided the mistake in Cuba, right? There was a debate about whether to take Cuba.
Yeah.
There was a debate about Cuba before the Civil War because the South wanted it to add another sort of slave-owning area, but it does trouble me that the poem that says the center will not hold, that and I think that the problem is that this rise of populism knocks down all these guardrails. The main logic when you see this Save America Act that Trump is pushing would eliminate the Senate filibuster. It would basically turn the Senate into a clone of the House, right? Where it's would be a fundamental change in how things work. But it seems to me that the best argument for it is not. The Save America Act, even though I think it is absolutely reasonable to ask people to somehow prove that they're an American citizen to vote in an election.
Yeah, I'd like to see it. I'd like to see it also with a system much like we do, selective service, that everybody, every citizen then gets a voting card when they're 18, and it said, a picture and an ID, and it's them, and they renew it every 5 years, whatever, because that's how you protect yourself. And I want both things. I don't want this. Well, we want the rule because the rule can be used to cut people out and make it harder. I mean, that's absolutely true in our history. So how do we not compromise this stuff? What is happening in our country that nobody can come to common sense?
You've got a situation in which if you vote with the other party on almost any issue, there are a few issues in which you can do a traditional log roll. You get an agricultural bill through, usually because the Democrats want the welfare aspects of it and the Republicans want the subsidies to farmers. So you can occasionally get things through.
Some common sense.
But
Does that include corn for wild pig?
I don't think so, Charlie.
Track wild pigs?
No, I'll tell you what it includes. It includes ethanol.
Yeah.
And that is just ludicrous. But you can't win a Republican primary in Iowa, presidential Republican, if you're against ethanol, right? It's a subsidy to farmers.
Or Illinois. It's my thing. My government subsidy. Don't you dare touch it.
I think the wild hogs are doing okay on their own, and the numbers are insane in the Midwest.
Oh, you checked it up? Yeah. Million.
Remember that it's the mascot of the University of Arkansas football and athletic teams. Yeah. They're the Razorbacks.
And they'll kill you if they find you.
They will. That's why it's to people I'm like, I'm gonna go camping in Missouri or Iowa. And I'm like, not by yourself, not without a gun. Don't protect yourself.
The bacon comes for you.
Yeah.
Even a gun, you have to, if you're not a good shot, it's not going to work.
Bear bangers, maybe.
You just make them angry. the other thing I found about Texas is that it is just remarkable. The major minority group here are Hispanics. And the amount of Hispanic entrepreneurs that run so many of the things is just remarkable. And in my particular area, there are huge numbers of South Asians who've come to work at Tesla and in the high tech industries. I don't know how many are citizens versus H-1B holders, but it's an ethnic mix in this area, but a very different ethnic mix than you see in some of the northern cities. Now, Chicago actually has more Hispanics than it has African Americans, but it doesn't have more Hispanic voters than it does African Americans.
Because we count them differently?
No. Well, for two reasons, I would say, John, but you may have a better take on this, and Jeff, you may too. The first reason is that some of the Hispanics are not here legally, but I think the bigger reason is that African Americans have been organized as a political group for almost a century. They were organized even under the old Chicago Daily Machine, and before the Daily Machine, there were people like Alderman Dawson who ran the black area, just as there were aldermen who ran the Jewish area, and there were aldermen who ran the Italian areas and the Greek areas and so forth. These were all well organized, and the Hispanics have not been around as long and are not nearly as well organized.
And they were organized on the basis of lining up behind the truck on election day to get your turkey, ham. When you got your ham, you knew what you had to do. You had to vote. And if you didn't vote, you didn't get another ham the next time.
Right, or you didn't get the job, or you didn't get the...
Right.
Yeah, right.
But I talked also to and read about how the old Chicago machine worked back in the days when it was really working.
Yeah.
And they had people down at the block level who would go house to house, and they weren't just going house to say, I want you to come out and vote for Joe Blow, or more likely Joe Bolonsky, they would go into your house and ask you, what's on your mind? What do you want? What do you need from us?
Right.
And often what you needed was a new garbage can, or there was a pothole. So there was a feedback element. And then you would be told, I'm wanting you to vote for our guys, and we can make sure you'll get that. And then they would hand them a sheet with who to vote for. But the main point, and then if I was in charge of my block for the Democratic machine, I would be held responsible for the vote that came in from my block. And it was easy to tell how people voted if they went into the booth and came out in 5 seconds, they had pulled the Democratic lever. I didn't want them in there for a long time.
one of the famous stories
is
of the 10th Ward Precinct Captain, Yukon Moose Chola.
I never even heard of him. Tell me the story.
He was a wrestler, a pro wrestler.
Okay.
And he was, you know, he made a living at that. And what he didn't like is when he would take a voter to vote.
Yeah.
What he didn't like is to see them shuffling their feet.
Oh.
You're behind the booth. You're at the booth, and he could see the feet. He didn't want you shuffling because he didn't want you to go Republican or Democrat. He just wanted
punch.
Both feet planted, pull the lever, and get out.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, there was a very famous book written about the Chicago political machine.
Rakoff?
Yes, Milt Rakoff.
Right.
By the way, Milt Rakoff's son is one of the most distinguished historians in America at Stanford University, historian of early American Revolution. But Milt himself was in political science at the University of Chicago getting his PhD, and he wanted to write about the machine. And Chicago sociology in particular believed that the way that you did these things was it was almost like the way they do anthropology. You lived with the natives. And you saw how the natives cooked their meat and killed their animals and planted their corn. Native.
Yeah. He went native, didn't he?
Yes. And he decided, he was told by his advisor, and he decided to do it, that the best way to learn about the Chicago machine was to volunteer and to actually work inside the machine. Not to wear a wire for it's just happened against Newsom out in California, or happened against a lot of Chicago people, but just to volunteer for the machine. And he goes and he asks the local ward healer, the ward boss, can he, in Hyde Park or whatever, can he volunteer? And this is just incomprehensible to the ward boss. And he asks him, what do you want?
We don't want nobody said,
you know, like, do you want a job in, do you want a job in streets and sanitation, or what do you want? And he says, I don't want anything. I just want to, you know, volunteer. And he says, who sent you?
Right.
who's asking?
who sent you? So it should be somebody who's well-connected and, you know, reliable member of the machine. And he says, well, nobody sent me. I'm just here to volunteer. And the title of his first book was from the answer the ward boss gave him, which was, we don't want nobody, nobody sent.
I'm sure the publisher, when they read this stuff, they thought, we got a gold mine here, because, I mean, every, like, Jack Parr and all the different talk shows in those days wanted Milt Rakoff on. Everybody wanted a book.
Yeah, we don't want nobody, nobody sent. And it's the perfect expression. I mean, I'm sure that if you volunteered to work for the Chicago Teachers Union in an election campaign, you would get that basically the same answer, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Like I keep volunteering for Tony Breckwinkle and she doesn't take me. I don't know why.
By the way, Tony was my next door neighbor in a small apartment. We had small apartments next to each other when I first moved to Chicago in the late 70s. Tony's husband at the time, they were Zeus, married for many, had the best name, Zeus Preckwinkle.
That's a powerful name.
Well, she was a member of that old liberal do-good, IVI, IPO, the old...
Independent Voters of Illinois, Independent Precinct Organization.
Do you, and you, you may not know this, Jeff, but when... Back in those days, when you were elected to the state legislature from a particular district, there were two from the majority party and one from the minority party.
Right.
Good old days.
And no, I mean, it was set up specifically that way. I assume that downstate, there were two Republicans and one Democrat. Is that how it worked, John?
It was about not concentrating power.
Yes.
And it was about, I guess, freedom in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically destroyed by none other than Dick Kay. You remember Dick Kay?
Yes, from Dick Kay from UIC, University of Illinois, Chicago.
Yeah, and he was on NBC and did a series of pieces about how piggish they were, how many members were down there. We had too many members.
Yeah.
They wanted, he thought that if he could get the numbers cut down.
Yes.
And you know what happened? Who took advantage of that? Mike Madigan.
Right. Dick Kay was NBC 5.
Yeah.
And I was mixing him up with Dick Simpson, but it was
a big gas bag.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was interesting. There were a lot of members, but this sort of two-in-one system ensured that there was a kind of moderation in the legislature, which ended when that system ended. That's why we need these kind of guardrails in the system. I'm trying to remember which great political philosopher said this, and it was about tearing down fences out in a rural area, and the statement was, don't tear down a fence until you know why the fence was put up in the first place.
Interesting.
And it's really true. If you're going to change all these rules in the Senate or the number of people in the Supreme Court, or
let what the people speak. Sure. Right, exactly.
Yeah. Remember why the fence was put up in the first place and what purpose it served, because that's what happened with the Illinois legislature, and look at the trouble we're in Illinois.
That's the theme of Jonathan Turley's book, John, we were talking about last week, The Rage in the Republic.
Do you know him, Charles?
I wish I did.
Me too. He's from Chicago.
He's from Chicago. He's a Chicago Catholic boy, I think, went through the parochial schools and so forth. And I would love to meet him. I think he's a very sensible guy.
Mm-hmm. He is. I'm halfway through the book, Rage in the Republic, The Unfinished Story of the American Revolution. And that's essentially the premise, Charles, is the nail it there, is that, you know, don't tear down fences unless you know what they're for. And the idea of getting a revolution is great, but then you build your fences, but you can't tear down your fences after your revolution because it's protecting you, right? It's protecting all of you.
Yes,
And it's a great read. I recommend everybody, especially in light of what's going on now. But I'm halfway through efforting, trying to get him on to talk to us, because he also reads it. It's a very soothing read.
I would love to join you or to connect up with him. But I want to say something actually about the 200th anniversary. Because, and contrasted to the 250th,
sure.
My sense of the 200th was that we were coming out of a very dark period.
Mm-hmm.
It was in 1976. We had gone through Vietnam. We'd just gotten out of Vietnam as losers. Nixon had been booted out, but before him, his vice president on corruption, Spiro Agnew.
What a fool. Yeah.
the Kennedys had been killed. Martin Luther King had been killed. So we were, and we had Gerald Ford as a kind of what Lyndon Johnson used to talk about legislation. To do to legislation what you did to hot coffee, you'd put it in the saucer and let it cool. And it was called saucered and blowed. And Gerald Ford was saucering and blowing the this overheated time in the Republic. But I was very fortunate. My thesis advisor, I was getting my PhD. I just got it at about that time. But my thesis advisor had a house that was right on Lexington, Massachusetts Green. Oh. And Lexington and Concord were where the first battles of the Revolution took place. And so I saw a reenactment on our 200th anniversary at the spot where things really began. It was really touching. And I feel like the story this year is the contrast between Trump at the underneath the carvings of the president at Mount Rushmore and Mondami saying how awful the country is.
Yeah, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, I got into an argument the other day with very left-leaning group who was making the case that where the discussion was, the premise of this discussion started as, why isn't the world talking about what's going on in other places where genocide has been absolutely proven and we know what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And the example was, you know, the Uyghurs, China, and
right.
You know, this Turkic Muslim group that's been for the last 20 years at least, have been systematically wiped off the planet, you know, their culture, everything.
Right.
And everybody looking at it says, well, we only see a little piece of what's going on and it looks like a genocide, so we've got to assume it's a full blown genocide. That my point is that I'm making that argument that, you know, it's because people are interested and you're being used. And these idiots are like, what? How can you say that? How can you say that's worse? And I'm like, wait a minute. You're trying to find there's a worse terp, a more bad genocide? That's where we're coming from. That's what we have to get to these people, that they don't even have a base level understanding of the what's bad. I mean, that's I was so depressed after this conversation because I couldn't get it through to them that the intent is the same. If you're going by the fact that you're saying Israel is creating a genocide, then how can you say one's worse than the other? What does that say about you as a person saying that this group is getting more attacked than that group? And I don't know how you can even begin to alter that.
I do find the kind of knowledge of the world combined with very biased reporting, mm-hmm. sort of weak knowledge, biased reporting, really make a toxic mix. In that regard, these TikTok videos of Europeans coming to America for the World Cup are the most stunning, because they realize firsthand they've been lied to.
Yeah.
Now, it's granted, they're not going to downtown Gary, Indiana, or Jackson, sure. Mississippi, right? They're right. not going to the worst parts of Chicago. That's all true, but they are going into a Costco or a Walmart. And by the way, if you look at the average income, the average income in England is lower than the average income in the poorest of the American 50 states, which is Mississippi. Mississippi has a higher average income. And that's not because there are a lot of billionaires in Mississippi or anything. It's just the average person in Mississippi is doing better than the average person in the United Kingdom. And this the divergence between America and America believes in new starts. That's why all those the West was such a an important part of the American story. You could just leave Massachusetts. You could leave Connecticut or New York. You could move and you could not only find cheap land, you could start over. Nobody knew what you were. There's an old story I assume apocryphal, of a law firm getting started in Chicago more than a century ago. And writing back east to see if they could get a new young lawyer to come and help out at the firm. And they were told that this particular candidate, his mother was a Cabot and his father was a Lodge. And the Chicago firm writes back and said, some confusion here needed for legal purposes, not breeding. And that's the American story. When I was a sophomore at Yale, one of my roommates' family had come over on the Mayflower, and the other had escaped from the Nazis. And in fact, the one whose family had escaped from the Nazis, his father was sweeping the floor in a hospital and was talking with a doctor in broken English about certain medical procedures. And the doctor said, well, how is it that you, who are sweeping my floor, know about medical procedures? And he said, well, I was a professor of medicine in Germany. And by the end of that man's life, the guy who was sweeping the floor, I had dinner with him, he was the head of his medical society in the state of New York. So we allow that in America, and to the extent that people do anything to block this kind of upward mobility, and to the extent that immigrants don't want to participate in it, spend all of their lives denigrating what we've achieved, I think we're losing something of what made America great.
Also, I think we should, before we go on, we should realize that 53%, or what did the Cato Institute come up with? Polls that showed 53% of the American people don't give two figs about the founding of this country. Why is that?
I blame teachers like Jeff Carlin.
Not me. Can't blame me yet,
Jeff. Tell us about your sense. You're becoming a teacher, a science teacher. Your sense of how these our public schools are doing.
Well, I will be speaking a little out of turn because I am actually set up to start my student teaching this fall and my observation in classroom live. A lot of what I've been doing is clinical, so simulated with clinicians who are offering similar, playing the role essentially of students with different, we call roadblocks in their education. In that, I will say that it's not only focused on, in that vein, it's not only focused on, you know, mental disabilities or learning disabilities. It's also really focused on, you know, a holistic sense. So, you know, children who speak a different language, or children who are, it's documented coming from a poor background and may not have resources at home, or and both parents may be working and the kids are alone, that kind of thing. So it's a little more holistic, I feel, than when maybe I was a kid and my parents were teaching, you know, when I was a young lad. As far as the, you know, that idea that the indoctrination or the
skipping or picking and choosing of history and facts and what we know. Mm-hmm. I haven't encountered that personally yet. However, I will say, right. However, I will say that I've encountered a lot of people in the pipeline who absolutely represent that worldview. And I worry about them being able to draw a line between it, because I've talked about this before. A teacher should not be in the role of indoctrination. A teacher should not be in the role of pushing any worldview other than explore and understand. I mean, that's what you should be teaching. Unless your kid, till a kid turns 18, they should be you should give them every piece of information about the world and worldview to let them have a toolkit to go out and experience life and hopefully build a toolkit of common sense. But when we start with a broken common sense baseline, like the genocidal question we were talking about before, it really makes it an uphill battle to correct that when they're an adult, when they're in the real world and they're seeing things, and then the world becomes too hard for them, and then they fall into the trap where then, well, they want handouts or they want this, they want someone to fix it for them. And that's the upstart mentality, kind of like you're talking about, how in Austin there's a lot of there's a second and third generation Hispanics and Latinos who are are blossoming, right? And it's because they had that upstart that had that mentality where I'm going to do it myself, and that is not being taught as much, I don't think. And I think the people who are teaching it are victims of the upbringing that led them to this point. And I'm not trying to call them victims for the sympathy's sakes, but victims for understanding that their whole worldview has essentially been handed to them by people who only have one objective, and is to indoctrinate them. And that's, that's unfair. And I think that's the biggest problem in Chicago.
Well, whoever gets you is going to be very fortunate, my friend. Very fortunate.
I hope so. It breaks my heart when I see these young people who they just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm also concerned about seeing that the students who are really smart and excelling have to end up in a separate school and are completely divorced from other ordinary students. It would be nice if the students who in your science classes who are really able to excel will have a chance to do that, but won't be, in effect, segregated from all the other students, because I think that this leads to this kind of stratified society.
Yeah, absolutely.
As long as they don't have to worry about talking white or thinking white.
See, I think that this really offensive. This is this sort of thing also represents a major change. It was always an issue for the immigrant parents that their children they spoke with a Yiddish accent, they spoke with a Italian accent or whatever, but they did feel to some extent that their children who were speaking without that ethnic accent were somehow slipping away from them, but they didn't try to hold them back. In fact, they often encouraged them, even as they saw them slipping away.
Exactly.
Guys, it is so great to talk with you.
Good to talk to you, Charles. Always, thank you so much for spending your time.
We'll have to get together every 100 years on the America's anniversary.
I think, Charles, I'd like to pitch to you a field trip for the Chicago Way podcast. And we should go incognito to the Obama Foundation Center, just so we can do an people here can get an unbridled review.
I think we should go, the three of us, holding hands.
Yeah. And if anybody stops us, we just tell them, hey, we're here. We identify as liberals today. Yeah. So,
we should get Bill Ayers to give us a tour. Good to talk to you guys.
Thanks, Charles. You too.
Thank you, Charles. For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago. For Jeff Carlin, my friend and WGN executive producer, and for me, John Cass, with a bad voice, and editor of John Cass News. Join us again next time for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN+.